Welcome to the Right to Track podcast, where we aim to get the hard facts about the human rights challenges facing us today. I'm Todd Landman, and today's episode we're asking, how do states commit food crimes, and how is this related to human rights? My guest is Rhoda Howard-Hassman, Canada Research Chair in International Human Rights at Wilfrid Laurier University in Ontario. She is author of Human Rights in Commonwealth Africa, Human Rights in the Search for Community, Compassionate Canadians, Civic Leaders Discuss Human Rights, Reparations in Africa, Can Globalization Promote Human Rights? And her new book is State Food Crimes. I'm really interested in the work you're doing, your most recent work on food crimes. So can you tell us a bit about the topic? What interested you in researching this topic?
Well, what started me off was actually an article by a law student named David Marcus that I read that was published in 2003. And he explained four levels of state food crimes, which were intentional, reckless, and then crimes by indifference and crimes by incompetence. And he argued that intentional starvation, governments that recklessly starve their citizens, should be considered actual international crimes. And so I got interested in that, and I decided on four case studies, which at the time I thought would fit the categories nicely. I decided on North Korea for intentional state crimes because there was a terrible famine in North Korea in the 1990s, and there is still severe food shortages and malnutrition and starvation in North Korea now. Then I thought of recklessness being the case of Zimbabwe, where there has been a severe shortage of food from about 2000 on as a consequence of the government recklessly confiscating large-scale farms owned by white farmers. Then I thought of indifference applying to Israel and its policies in the West Bank and Gaza, which I thought contributed to malnutrition. And then finally, for incompetence, I took the case of Venezuela under Hugo Chavez, where he attempted to introduce policies that would actually help the poor, but in the end introduced policies that caused severe food shortages. These also had the advantage of being countries that were in Asia, Africa, the Middle East, and Latin America. And then along the way, I got interested in malnutrition among Aboriginal people in Canada. And I looked at a particular case of government indifference to a famine that occurred in the west of Canada in 1870. But I've also been looking at the very high rates of malnutrition among Aboriginal Canadians today.
So this is a fascinating array of cases. And before we get into some of the detail of those cases, I wanted to ask you about the law on this issue. So, you know, is there international law on food crime? Is there does human rights law help in any way? Where do you go for the sort of I know the article delineated these different crimes, but what's the sort of legal basis for these types of claims?
Well, Marcus recommended, and I agree, that all the different laws on food should be consolidated into one international treaty, like, for example, the International Treaty Against Torture. So there is human rights law, which says that everyone has the right to be free from hunger, and that everyone has the right to adequate nutrition. And those are in Article 11 of the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. Also under the International Criminal Court, which has been operational since 2002, there is a clause prohibiting extermination of populations as a crime against humanity, and deliberate starvation of populations is considered part of extermination. And then there's laws about right to food all over the place, but they haven't been consolidated, and they don't provide for much by way of punishment, even punishment of individuals. There has never been a case where extermination by starvation has been taken to the International Criminal Court. The other problem is that through the 70s and 80s and into the 90s, international documents such as the Right to Development attributed most starvation to international markets, especially capitalist markets, to colonialism and to apartheid. But they did not look at the internal policies of governments. They did not look at deprivation of civil and political rights. They did not look at use of food as a political weapon until about the 1990s. So since about the 1990s, there have been statements that use of food as a political weapon is prohibited.
Right. And so when a lot of people look at these issues, they often point to sort of the structural reasons for famine, And they point to the sort of socioeconomic problems. They might even point to some of the natural environmental factors that lead to drought and things like that. But you're actually making a much stronger argument. You're making an argument around a perpetrator and a certain intentionality, whether it's by commission or omission. So how does one take the step from the structural, as it were, to the more individual or intentional side of the argument?
I'm not an expert on malnutrition and famine in every part of the world. And one person from India pointed out to me the extreme level of malnutrition in India, for example. There is a famous Indian, originally Indian, economist and philosopher named Amartya Sen. And Sen's contribution was to argue that famines were partially caused by governments that did not allow elections, political opposition, and freedom of the press. So if people were starving, essentially there was no way they could vote their governments out of office if the governments caused the starvation, and the press didn't have the chance to criticize governments. That is a very important contribution, and it's based in part on his work on the Irish famine of the 19th century. So in my introduction to my book, I deal with three famines in communist countries: the famines in the Soviet Union and Ukraine in the 30s, the famine caused by the so-called Great Leap Forward in China in the late 50s and early 60s, and starvation under the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia in the 1970s. These were all totalitarian regimes. But I then look at starvation in democratic and quasi-democratic countries to show that even if there is a free press and there's some voting, it's not necessarily the case that you can stop famine. So the Aboriginal case is one that I talk about in the 1870s in Canada, where there was a free press and there was voting, but it was only for white people. It wasn't for the Aboriginal people themselves. I also look at the Irish famine. Again, there was a free press and voting for English people, but not for the Irish peasants who were starving. And lastly, I look at the starvation caused in Germany between the armistice of November 11, 1918, and the peace treaty of June 29, 1919, where the British intensified their blockade of Germany, and the result seems to have been maybe 250,000 excessive deaths from starvation. So what I'm trying to show here is that even in democratic countries, the governments can take decisions which cause or exacerbate or ignore starvation.
So this is a really, really important exception, if you will, to the Sen thesis. And it seemed to me, in what you were describing, is it really hinges on the degree to which groups are enfranchised. So you made the point that, you know, that democracy existed in the sense that there was choice, but only certain groups in society had the ability to make those choices. So is there a case today of a fully enfranchised country that has universal suffrage, etc., where this is taking place? Or is it really under those conditions of limited franchise, even though there is free press, etc.?
Well, it's more than that. What I concluded from my four cases is that the rights that Sen talked about, such as the franchise, are insufficient. So putting together my four cases, I came up with four other rights that were very important. They were, first of all, the right to actual citizenship. So in North Korea, nobody's really a citizen in the sense of active citizenship. Everybody is really just an inhabitant or perhaps a subject of the government. In Zimbabwe, white people were effectively deprived of their citizenship. Now, what's important here is not the white people, but the consequences of depriving the white people of their property. Because the consequence by violent land invasions of white-owned property was severe underproduction of food. Zimbabwe used to be self-sufficient in food and exported food. But when the white people were deprived of their property, something like 300,000 farm laborers were also deprived of their own livelihood. Production of food declined drastically. And also many of the farm laborers were not considered citizens of Zimbabwe because they might have been born elsewhere or their parents were born elsewhere. And then if we look at the West Bank and Gaza, of course the problem is that this is a colonial situation, in my view, that Israel is in fact a settler colonial power in the West Bank, and the people living in the West Bank are not citizens of Israel. They are also ruled by corrupt, violent internal groups such as Fatah in West Bank and Hamas in Gaza. So I do not want to suggest that it's only Israel that's responsible for malnutrition in those two areas. So then the next category was the right to mobility. which is also the right to stay where you want to stay. So in North Korea, people were not allowed to look for food during the worst of the famine. So they couldn't go, say, if they had a relative in the countryside with a bit more food, they couldn't go get it. They couldn't forage for fruits and nuts and berries in the forest. If you were caught looking for food in the forest, which otherwise would rot, you could be shot for that. So there's that kind of problem. And then the right to stay put in Zimbabwe in 2005, something like 700,000 people were expelled from the cities because the government thought they mostly voted for the opposition. So by the end of the decade, you had something like 1 million internally displaced people in Zimbabwe. Then there's the right to own your property, and people often think of this as the right of the capitalist class to own huge amounts of property, and that is indeed a problem. But what I'm concerned with is the right of peasants to own their own land and the right of indigenous people to own their own land. So when governments come in and say, all land is now collectivized, in effect, you are completely dependent on the government. And it's the government that's going to decide whether you eat or not. So I would rather go for a circumscribed and carefully regulated right for property, even for rich white people in Zimbabwe. So I would rather go for that than a situation where nobody has property. And finally, just the right to work. Well, again, in the West Bank, one of the problems is that the Israelis have taken over, the government has taken over a lot of land. Because it's taken over that land, it has deprived many Palestinian farmers of access to their own land, and so that they can't work their own land. So this has also happened in Venezuela. I haven't really talked about it in Venezuela, but in Venezuela, the government has instituted price controls, and what that means is that selling food, you're not allowed to sell it often at the cost of the actual production of food. So people who produced food before don't have the right to work. One case was when the government decided that 40 butchers were overcharging for meat. So it arrested those butchers, beat up a few of them, and the result was the butchers stopped being butchers and just gave up their businesses. So I think that what this amounts to is that there's no place that I know of where an economic right, the most basic economic right to food, is not affected by the deprivation of civil and political rights.
And that's really the insight that's crucial here, is that we often hear in declarations and in legal discourse about the interrelatedness of rights, but you're giving us really clear, concrete examples of how rights are interrelated, and that in the absence of the protection of some of the rights you mentioned about mobility, about property, about work, etc., then other rights are also infringed, and therefore that interrelatedness means that the human condition and the agency associated with the human condition can find itself on the wrong side of history, if you will.
To put it mildly.
Yes. And in the case of Venezuela, I mean, here this sounds like a case of unintended consequences of purposive social action, right? This is the old Merton phrase. And it's this idea that, you know, there may have been some sort of enlightened vision around keeping prices low and therefore giving access to goods and services in the Venezuelan economy in a kind of Bolivarian revolutionary way. But in the end, the downside of all of that was that it actually made the very thing they were trying to make accessible, inaccessible.
Yeah, I think originally it was unintended consequences. So originally, when Chavez took power in 1999, I would have said that this was a regime that was just incompetent. There's all sorts of literature that tells you that price controls don't work. What you get with price controls is a dual market economy. So somebody's selling soap. Well, let's not use soap. Let's use rice at a low price. Somebody else buys it, takes it to the market, and sells it for a much higher price. So say the controlled price is a dollar, the market person sells it for $3, so the real price is actually $2. And this is what happens when you have price controls. You have a black market that evolves. And in Venezuela also, you had a similar kind of problem with foreign exchange. You have had and have the official price, how many bolivars, that's the currency for an American dollar, versus the real price, how many bolivars for an American dollar. So I first noticed this and had my own personal experience about it when I lived in Ghana many years ago in 1974 as a graduate student writing my first book, which was called Colonialism and Underdevelopment in Ghana. And I saw how the control prices and the black market prices interacted. But since then, in the later years of his rule, Chavez became extremely dictatorial. He started firing judges or packing courts. He essentially took over the media. He had farcical periodic elections, but, for example, the opposition would be allowed 3 minutes per day on media time, and Chavez would be allowed 6 hours per day or however much time he wanted. There has been political violence in Venezuela, and since Chavez died in 2013 and his successor, Nicolas Maduro, took over, there's been a great deal of political violence. And we're now waiting to see what's going to happen in Venezuela. Many people are protesting because they don't have food. There have been now reports of malnutrition and indeed starvation in Venezuela. So we don't know. Is there going to be a revolution against Maduro? Is there going to be a military coup? Is he himself going to take over and institute a complete dictatorship?
It's really interesting because there were food riots in Venezuela before. There were petrol riots in Venezuela around prices. And this is a country that is awash in oil. And yet the proceeds of that industry don't seem to, you know, in a sense, being used for providing basic access to food.
Well, if you look at Chavez's rule, when the price of oil is high, then the amount of malnutrition falls. But when the price of oil is low, then there's more malnutrition. So it's essentially an oil-dependent economy, and Chavez was not the first person to have these policies. Chavez is probably the first person to abolish private property or to significantly curtail private property. So, for example, he also encouraged land invasions. Recently, I met a Venezuelan refugee whose family had owned a ranch that produced both cattle and grains and so on. Her family's ranch was invaded around 2000, I think, and now it doesn't produce anything. And so much of the allegedly state-owned farms are just not producing anymore.
Yes, and the point you make about the price of oil is telling, because over the last several years, the price of a barrel of oil has dropped precipitously. Here in the UK, we were paying less than a pound for a litre of petrol when, you know, a few years before that, it was up around £1.30. And now it's creeping back up again because the price of a barrel of oil has gone up. So this interrelationship between the oil price and the prevalence of malnutrition is telling. I'm curious if we could turn then to the accountability around all of this. So, you know, a legal argument is based around sort of who can we hold accountable for these things and what are the mechanisms available? How would the human rights community or a community interested in some of these injustices that you're pointing out do anything with the information that you have yielded in your study?
Well, there's no law against having an incompetent economic policy. Sovereign governments are allowed to be as incompetent as they want. So effectively, the human rights gatekeepers on economic rights of this kind are the wrong agencies. The International Monetary Fund and the World Bank can say to a government, well, you're in crisis, we won't help you unless you do X, Y, and Z, as occurred during structural adjustment in the 1980s and 90s. But those two organizations have very, very weak human rights mandates. And you can't really start taking governments or individuals from governments to jail for being incompetent. So that's the one level, the lowest level of what you might call state food. It's not even a crime. Then again, for indifference, that's a hard one. You might be able to say, well, your indifference is causing malnutrition. But again, it doesn't result in the level of what we would call justiciability, the judges being able to make rulings on this. So where you get to justiciability is on intentionality and recklessness. Now, if you are causing starvation or malnutrition among particular racial, ethnic, national, or religious groups, then you are covered by the Convention Against Genocide. And you could be taken to court, to the International Criminal Court, and accused of genocide. So that would have applied, for example, in the 1970s in Cambodia to the Khmer Rouge officials who deliberately starved, for example, Muslim Cham, who were a particular ethno-religious group. But it doesn't apply to a government like North Korea that just starves its own people. They're all ethnic Korean, and they don't have a different religion. Religion is banned.
So there's no group status that you know that's being violated in that case, right?
Yeah, so this is what the genocide scholars Barbara Harf and Ted Robert Gurr call politicide. It's starving people for political reasons, but not necessarily because they're members of particular groups. But politicide is not a legal term, but that kind of starvation, again, would be covered by crimes against humanity. So hypothetically, you could take Kim Jong-un, who's the ruler of North Korea, to the International Criminal Court. and accuse him, among many other things, of extermination via starvation. In fact, in 2014, a UN Commission of Inquiry on North Korea recommended that certain unnamed people be taken to the International Criminal Court for precisely those reasons. However, the problem here is that North Korea also is developing a nuclear bomb. So we have the food security of North Koreans versus the absolutely elementary right to life of anyone who lives in the region who might be killed by a North Korean nuclear bomb. So the big issue in North Korea internationally is controlling its nuclear aspirations. And so then you have the question of engagement versus containment. Do you engage with this kind of regime, as, for example, the United States recently did with Iran, in order to stop it developing a nuclear bomb? Or do you punish it? Do you sanction it? And the international community on North Korea has gone back and forth.
It's a classic dilemma, isn't it? So I think, in summary, the kind of work that you're doing here highlights a number of things of interest to the listeners of the Rights Track. One, I think, is this the sort of interrelatedness of rights, that you've shown that by analyzing state food crimes of any of the four categories, and you have good illustrative case studies that show that, as well as the historical stuff, really shows us how human rights are interrelated, and that we still, in a way, the international law is quite specific about some things, not powerful enough in other areas, and this whole question of accountability is a tough one to prove. And then I think finally you've made this observation about competing priorities in the policy sphere around the realist concerns over power and access to weaponry and nuclear bombs, etc., and the trade-offs that the international community faces. But equally, the dependence of national economies on particular products and how that interrelates with access to food. So it's an extraordinarily complex topic area, and one which you've delved into in fantastic fashion. So I just wanted to say, from the Rights Track, in this episode of the Rights Track, thank you so much for joining us today, Rhoda, and wish you the very best.
Thank you.
This episode of the Rights Track was presented by Todd Landman and produced by Chris Garrington of Research Podcasts. The Rights Track podcast project is funded by the Nuffield Foundation, and you can find out more at www.rightstrack.org.